Hello, and welcome to the Physician Financial Success Podcast. My name is Josh Metal, and this is the podcast dedicated to advising physicians how to avoid financial landmines. Today, we'll be talking with Cynthia Hale, retired asset protection and landlord-tenant law attorney. She's a third-generation real estate investor and property manager. She's the purveyor of motherofalllandlords.com. Currently, she also co-owns and self-manages about 100 single-family, multifamily, and apartment units in the Salt Lake City area. And if that were not enough, she's also my business partner and an incredible mother. Mom, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
I'm great. How are you, bud?
I'm doing great. I'm excited to have an opportunity to talk real estate with you. We recently chatted with a good friend of mine, Dave Denniston, and he invited me on to do a podcast about real estate. And I had so much fun, I thought, you know, we should do a podcast on my podcast for our listeners, all about real estate. So here we go. We're going to kick it off.
That was a great podcast, by the way.
Yeah, I'm going to post it up on our podcast recording so all of our listeners will be able to get a peek inside that one.
What I really like about it, it'll be different than what we talked about today because that was more left brain. You really drilled down the numbers and really explained why real estate's so fantastic. I'm going to give you a little more of a right brain view of real estate. So how do you like that?
Sounds like twice as much brains as I have. So I like it. All right. Well, let's just kick it off with just a little bit of background and history about you and maybe what took you from landlord to attorney and then back to landlord for our properties now today.
Okay. Well, boy, you're taking me way back. If you'll remember, I was a landlord about 8 years before I became a homeowner because I bought my first rental house out in Riverside, California when you were about seven.
Yeah.
And you used to practice your karate out front. I have pictures of you doing your karate practicing while you were moving the hose around to water the lawn for me. So there you go. So then my mom and dad had to foreclose on 90 units in West LA City, Utah. And they had sold it and took back a note, and the people that bought it decided not to pay. So when they took it back, it had more than 50 vacancies and 15 years of deferred maintenance. And Dad wrote me and my brothers and sister a letter saying, come help me put this thing back together and save the asset for the estate, or I'm going to wholesale it and go to Acapulco, and you can all hold your peace. So two of us showed up, and it took us 5 years to get that property back into order and sell it again. And during that time, I was finishing off an undergraduate degree and had a little pile of money in my pocket at the end of that project and decided to go to law school. And then when I got out of law school, I graduated at the age of 45. So I didn't have a real long runway to, you know, if I'd been 30 when I graduated, I probably would have been a constitutional law attorney because I took every constitutional law and real estate law class I could ever find. Those are my two loves. But at the age of 45, it was going to be real estate because I needed to practice and make some money right now. So when I started practicing, you know, gosh, I was heading towards a big number, a big birthday with a zero on the end. And as I started heading towards that, I realized, oh my gosh, I just bought myself a job and my body is required. What was I thinking? So you actually decided that I should go on a five-year plan. I think we had a little argument one day and you said, you're going on a five-year plan. And I thought that was a great idea. I knew I had five more good years left into me and I really wanted to do it. So that's when we started investing and the rest is history.
That's a great story. I think that the physicians and other professionals that are our listeners can recognize with or identify with these three words. My body is required. Sorry, I only wrote my body required. That'd be four words. My body is required. And my body required to make income is the same realization that a lot of our physician listeners have. And with the changes in the medical system as a whole, there is fear and apprehension that incomes will be going down and work might potentially be going up. You know, more body, less money is an equation that nobody likes.
And I just hit it faster than everybody else because I graduated from law school late. when you first start into practice, it's very heady. It's exciting. It's thrilling. It's playing with the big boys and the big girls. And then suddenly when you have a birthday with a zero on it coming up, it looks just a little different for a minute and it gets scary.
Yeah. Well, I think your story will have very similar parallels to what a lot of our listeners are listening to. So that's a great opening. So let's talk about our properties. How are our properties doing today? How would today's landlord rental markets compare to years past? And where do you think rents are headed in the future?
Wow, those are three universes of questions. But right now, as a landlord, life is sweet. There's way more renters in the market than there is property. They're building like crazy here in Salt Lake, so they're trying to catch up with that. But, you know, you could get lazy, fat and lazy in a market like this as a landlord. And the last time I did that was just before the recession, and I was taking vacations with my mom, and summer was going on. That's when all apartments turn over because people want to move when it's nice weather, not bad weather. So that's when you have the most tenants in the market looking, and that's when you really have to take advantage and fill those apartments up fast. And I was busy taking vacations, and it went into September, and my apartments had not filled up. And that's when I realized there was a recession that had already been going on for about 6 months, and I was too full of myself to figure it out fast enough. So I am very careful not to let that happen again. So right now, since the market is good, I use all my skills every day. I research our units every single time. I research to see where the market's at every single time before I put another apartment on the market for rent. I pump them as high as I dare, and I use my skills every single day, and I'm never going to get lazy again, because when times are bad, you really have to use your skills, and I'm not going to let mine get lazy again. I've learned that lesson. Recently you and I decided to renovate an apartment complex that we've held for, I don't know how many years it's been, 12, 15 years. But, you know, we couldn't find anything good on the market to buy because owners want to hold on during a good market, mm-hmm. and then they'll want to sell during a bad market, which is exactly the time that it's hardest to buy. So kind of all messed up like that. But we couldn't find anything good. And we went, well, hey, well, we got this apartment complex. Let's renovate it just like we just bought it in a new unit at a time and be really smart investors. And so we did that. And when we got done, I pumped the rents as far as I dared. And the last one, I just set it up ridiculously high, and it rented in 2 hours. It's just a great tenant. So that's the market right now. I just rented three houses in the last few months that turned over, and I had people just lining up at the door, and just piles of people going through, and I went, what the heck is going on? And so every time that happens, I think, man, I didn't charge enough money. I already researched, charged as much as I dared. So isn't that just the craziest market ever?
Yeah, it's a fantastic market to be a landlord. Vacancy is not a concern right now. And I think you bring up an interesting comment about, we did some research and we were thinking about, how do we invest in real estate today? You know, how do we add to our portfolio? And the numbers just didn't really make sense. In other words, what people were charging for the condition of the properties we're in, yep. You know, you're just, you're parking cash for a rate of return that's not going to come back for way too many years that I'm comfortable with. So we decided, you know, and this is what I love so much about real estate, is there's so many different ways you can come at it and get creative with it. So what we decided to do was, instead of buying a new property, let's put a bunch of money to work in the properties we already have, modernizing them, new windows, new kitchens, you know, pumping them where we can get the most bang for the buck in terms of raising rents and increase our yields that way. Then when you go into a slower market, you've got properties that don't have deferred maintenance, and you've got top rents going into a potential downturn in the future.
And just fantastic tenants, because the nicer your units are, the better you can attract a really great tenant. They're the ones paying the bills. That's
agreed.
Where the value is.
Yeah. So, you know, just one of those other questions was, where do we think rents are headed? And I think that a lot of people, and I'd like your thoughts, but my thought is a lot of people, a lot of the younger generations, have been kind of scared going through this mortgage meltdown process. And they've seen their parents and they've seen their friends lose homes, get foreclosed upon, go through divorces, kind of go through these traumatic experiences that happened during that meltdown. And I think it's put fear in a few people. And they've decided that they're just comfortable renting for the time being. And at some point, I think that that mentality will change. But right now, that seems to be prevalent. What do you see, and what do you think where rents might be headed?
You know, I just have to think that those people are so risk averse, they're just going to trip over themselves. You can't predict everything. All you can do is say, what are my goals in life, and where am I headed, and what's the best thing for me and my family? You just can't be worried about what the economy is doing, because you can't predict it. We didn't predict the recession. We were out there banging the world and investing and doing stuff, and then we got caught with a few that we'll talk about in a minute. But I mean, you just can't predict everything. You just have to do the best that you can. It's a crazy time, and you and I both study different economists, and they disagree, and we're always talking about it. And I personally think there's going to be a longer runway for this little rock ride for landlords, but I'm staying alert. But gosh, if you to be a renter, look, I have an 80-something-year-old tenant. She's paying a grundle of money. She's basically having to go out and get charity, paying a grundle of money for that two-bedroom apartment, where everybody in her age group hasn't paid a mortgage payment for 30 years. You got to plan ahead. You just can't get stuck being a renter forever. I love renters. They're wonderful people. I love my tenants. They're on their way up. They're trying to go someplace in the world. But don't get caught just being a renter forever, because you can't predict the future. Because guess what? You're never going to predict the future. Get over it.
No, it's a great point. Great point. Okay, so you know, as you know, our audience, I think we've got a pretty good view. They're mostly docs, dentists, other high income individuals, and I know that our listeners are extremely busy, and they may know very little about investing in real estate. So what I'd like to do is just try and lay out a few of the mistakes that we have made over the years, and kind of give them a little bit of a roadmap if we can. So what are the things that a busy first-time real estate investor should consider when they evaluate their first real estate investment?
Well, doctors and professionals are probably more left-brain thinkers, and you speak their language better than I do, and that's why that dentist and podcast you just recently put up is so fantastic, because it just explains the numbers of why real estate is great so well. You know, the tax deductions, the money you get to keep in your family because of that, the leverage of investing a relatively small amount of money and reaping appreciation on the whole value of the property, and the numbers when you consider the tenants paying down your mortgage over years and all that good stuff. That you speak to better than I do. You've been pushing my nose into it more and more. But let me just say, I like this part about kicking the dirt. And let me just say to people that are high-income earners and want to know what to do with their money and stay in control, that there's a lot to be said about bootstrapping. Don't wait until you have a doctorate degree in real estate investing before you jump in. Because I took every real estate class in the world I could possibly get. I was top academic 1%, and that's about how much I knew when I started investing in real estate. So you have to learn by doing. There's just lessons you will never learn otherwise. Hmm. So just start. Professionals work themselves to the bone, and you know, you can't do that forever. You have to think at a certain point you're going to have to transition from earned income to passive income. And, you know, this morning I got up and had 2 ounces of fresh squeezed ginger with lemon juice and cayenne. That's my age group. Luckily, I have a little money machine built that just rolls along, even when I'm not feeling great or dealing with my parents' issues. This is what will happen when you get into my age group. Plan ahead. Have a little money machine. It's a ton of fun, especially a ton of fun when you do it with family like we do.
I think that's great. Yeah, I mean, you can analyze this thing and be so risk averse to the point where there's just paralysis.
Yeah.
And, you know, nobody ever got successful or rich in real estate by letting paralysis take over. So, you know, as is with stocks, you should practice position sizing. Your first property probably shouldn't be, you know, worth 50% of your net worth, or be, you know, your cash 50% of your net worth. You should take a smaller property, learn some lessons, make a few mistakes, do a few things correctly. Oh, that feature that only cost a few dollars really helped us rent this. Great. Now recreate that on another property, maybe a little nicer. Recreate that on a multifamily, two or three or four units. And then it just grows. And along the way, you make a bunch of little mistakes. You learn a lot of lessons, and you have some little victories that then parlay and build and grow into more and more success. So if you don't get started, you can't get to the good stuff. So it's a great lesson. Just get started.
It's like anything else. Eventually, you're going to get your sea legs, and then you can weather the storm and move on to the next level.
I love it. It's great. Okay, so let's talk about our mix of properties. We got started with a few single family properties, and originally got started, we thought we were going to flip, right? We were going to buy and fix and sell, and we figured out we were dismal at that. And
we're the worst flippers in the world.
Oh, we're seriously the worst. I literally don't know how you could be any worse. It's pretty bad.
Yeah.
But that led us to what we were good at. So through mistakes comes eventual success, and we moved on to small apartment buildings over the years. So let's just talk a little bit about, we'll get into maybe some mistakes we made in the future of this podcast, but, let's just talk about property types and currently of our properties we've invested in, which do you personally prefer and why?
Okay, well, I think single-family residences are a great way to start because the loans are easy to get. It's a small economy of scale, and it's easy to start that way and cut your teeth on it. So I would still think that is a great way to start. Looking back on it, I think a duplex or a fourplex, which are also easy to get loans on and easy to start, is another great way. So I would start in that order of magnitude. And, you know, having tried just about everything, you and I really prefer the multiple unit properties, partly because I was in a big hurry, and I just one by one was just not fast enough for me. And so we acquired assets by getting an eightplex, and then of course our very next one was a 36-plex, so there's a gradient for you. Anyway, one of the things I like better about the larger complexes personally is when you have a house vacant, you have 100% vacancy rate. And that is scary. You got all the money going out, none of the money coming in. But if you have a fourplex, you have a vacancy, you can have a 25% vacancy rate, and you still have three other units paying the bills. So that's what I like about it, is that you have other people paying the bills while you're weathering the little storms. And, you know, when you get into bigger properties, you get an economy of scale where you and I started out, we went out and did all of our own renovations and our own cleaning, everything. I won't tell them how bad it was because I don't want anybody to copy what we did, because we were negative cash flow to start out with. That was before I read Rich Dad Poor Dad. You made me read it. And then after that, I was just absolutely intolerable of negative cash flow. I could never tolerate it after that. But we started out doing all the work ourselves. And when we got a few more units, there's an economy of scale where you can get some really great help, great people, and you don't have to do it all yourself. And it just rolls along.
So. Yeah. I think that's great. Just a couple things I'd like to add on to that. You know, we started with the sell strategy, buy and sell. And especially for our, you know, high income listeners, adding additional income to today's tax bracket or this year's income is probably not the best benefit. What we've evolved into doing, and I say that, you know, time cures all stupidity in real estate. So even if you make a stupid move, which we've made plenty of them, and you rent the property out, time cures that. In other words, if you buy at the wrong time and you rent it out and you have a positive cash flow, well, every month you're banking a couple hundred bucks a month. As time goes on, the appreciation catches up and it washes over your mistakes. So for us, renting long-term has always been the key. And one other thing you said, Mom, that was kind of interesting, I just want to say it a little different way. In a traditional investment format, where you're talking about stocks and bonds, there's lots of talks about diversification. So one kind of diversification that we use is we use multi-unit properties. So like you said, if you have one property, 100% vacancy rate, if you've got four units and one's vacant, you have a 25%. Well, that's just diversifying a little bit, not necessarily diversifying in asset classes, but you're diversifying in your tenants. So you've got, if one goes down, you've got the other three that are carrying you.
And different areas of town, because there's different economies in different areas of town.
Yep. Good point. Okay. So let's take a guess that a few of our listeners are, speaking of tax brackets, are of fairly high tax rates and maybe a potential for lots of outstanding student loans. So traditional investment advice would have them max out their retirement accounts, contribute as much as they can to their 401k, IRAs, and then buy a big primary residence. Both of those things would bring down their effective tax rate and then likely allocate the rest of their investable income, if there's any left, to debt reduction and potentially funding non-qualified investment accounts. So what might you do differently if you were in a high income, high student loan type situation? And how would you look at that maybe a little differently than the traditional advice?
You know, that's entirely theoretical to me, because I was a single mom for 14 years, poor as a church mouse, and I never had to deal with the pains of being a high-income doctor. And I became medium income, you know, good income as an attorney, but I really never felt that pain. I feel it through you, but I don't feel it personally. My decision for real estate is that I just never felt comfortable with my money or assets in the hands of somebody else. Maybe it's just my arrogance that I can do better than somebody else. You know, I want to be able to go out and kick it. So I like real estate as a personal preference. And also for me, the reason that I like real estate is I had a short runway. I didn't have years and years of savings, setting aside in retirement plans and whatnot to get ready for retirement or to set aside for emergencies. I had a short runway. I had to do it fast. And the fastest way to grow an estate for me was real estate. There's just no faster way to do it.
That's a great point. And let's just park on that for a second. So, you know, philosophically, the traditional investment advice out there is save as much as you can, contribute to those retirement accounts, and then when you retire and income goes away, you start to draw off of those assets. And that right. model can work well if you have a long runway and decent appreciation rates. If you have a short runway or poor market performance or both, then you don't have the time to build that nest egg that you're then going to pull off of each month for the rest of your life. So you have to build cash flow. And the thing that's so cool about real estate is that you're never spending the principal. In other words, if I own five properties and they're free and clear, or they have 50% debt or whatever, and now I reach this point of retirement, I don't start selling off my properties. I just start living off the cash flow. So that principal is not, you know, this, I think mentally there's a shift. If I've got a big capital account that I'm pulling off of each year, it's like my lifeline is running out, right? Like it's like the sands through the hourglass and I can see myself, okay, I got to die right about when this money's going to run out.
Exactly.
It's a very finite kind of thinking. Conversely, with real estate, your principal continues to appreciate. Your tax rate is still going to stay very low because you'll have some depreciation benefits and real estate write-offs, and you get to live off the cash flow. So when you've got a shorter runway like that, especially for you, I like the way you related that to your own life. Really, the only way to get there was to invest in real estate, make sure you had cash flow, and in 10 years, you didn't have to live off the principal. You just needed to make sure you had enough cash flow to survive.
Yeah, you could do a whole podcast. We could have done this whole podcast just on cash flow alone, because there's nothing more than important than cash flow. And we've watched other investors. You talked about that in the Denison interview. We've watched other investors just completely tank because they didn't have cash flow. Cash flow will get you through anything. And
that's
not
right.
only that, but later on in your life, when you're paying yourself cash flow out of your rental unit, that's not income. That's not earned income. That's capital gains, and you're paying taxes. You're spending equity, not income.
Excellent point.
Taxes are lower.
Excellent point. Thank you very much. Really good point. Okay. I know we're having fun when we reach the 29-minute mark of a 30-minute podcast, and we've got three questions to go. So we're going to run a few minutes long, but we got to be succinct because this is the fun stuff. So so here we go. This is the speed round. Are you ready, Mom?
Sure.
Okay, great. All right. So let's share with our listeners just a lesson or two that you've learned to make you a better investor today that you were 15 years ago. Just give me your top lesson or two that you've learned.
Well, I think some of the best stuff I've learned was I learned from you. And that's because you forced me to run the business like a business. You kept pushing my nose in the financials, and that's really your hat, but you pushed my nose into it. You made me confront. And we're doing it Sunday. I mean, you make me do it every month to go over to P&L every month. And some months, that's just torture. Like when we're renovating a complex and I've got money going out and I have to face you with the financials, it's like, oh my gosh, you're kidding me. And I have Hillary asking me, where are we going to get the money for this? And where are we going to get the money for that? The last thing I want to do is face you, because I already know how bad it is when the money's going out. But it makes me crack the whip. It makes me move it along fast and get it done. I just want to be the hero after it's all done. I don't want to have to face it when I'm going through it, but it makes me a better investor when you force my face in those numbers every month. So that was only one, but that's the best lesson. How about that?
No, that's great. I think it's Tim Ferriss in his book, The 4-Hour Work Week, or maybe it's The 4-Hour Body, actually. But you know, he talks a lot about anything measured will be improved. So anything that you measure, if you want to lose weight, start measuring how many calories you put in your body versus how much exercise, and start logging that every single day. You will lose weight. You know, hang that up in your cubicle or in your office. You know, if you want to save money and accumulate savings. Every day, write out how much money you brought into your account versus how much money you spent. So anything that you chronicle, that you really pay attention and measure, will improve because you'll start to put attention on it. And that's a great lesson for investors. You know, you have to confront those numbers every month and say, what did we spend? How much did we make? Are we positive? And how can we do better? And those are the questions that if you're running a business, those are the questions you would be doing at least monthly, reviewing those types of figures. That's how you have to treat real estate. It's a business. It's all about cash flow. How did we do? What can we do better?
Yep. And it's painful sometimes, but it always makes you a better investor when you confront it.
Very true. Good. All right. I love it. All right. So now let's have a little fun. Before we wrap up the interview, let's talk about the maybe the worst deal that we've ever gotten ourselves into, because I think people can learn more from our failures than our successes. And then maybe let's end with one deal that we did well. Go ahead, Mom. Give us our biggest failure.
Okay. Well, you're not going to predict that I would say this one. I think, you know, all of our worst deals is when we were trying to be flippers. There's no doubt about that. We had a great bundle of stories about how we failed as flippers. But there's just one that I just got to tell. Okay, so we bought this little house just before the recession hit. We were still hitting it as the recession was hitting and loans were disappearing, so we were having trouble selling it. Little house next to a graveyard. It was about 1,000 square feet. And we renovated it happily, got it ready. We thought, since the recession was hitting and you were right on it and you knew it, we thought we better sell it and just move on. So we put it on the market, and okay, so around this house are these giant pine trees. And every day they would drop a bunch of junk all over the patio and the deck and the driveway and everything. And spiders would come down out of the trees and encase the house in webs. So you cannot learn this stuff in law school, or you can't learn it in real estate school. This stuff will happen. You just have to market your little heart out. So I had to go over there every single day, sweep the spider webs off of the house so prospective tenants wouldn't see that their house was going to be entombed by spiders every day, and sweep all the tree garbage off the whole property. And you know, you're probably looking around wondering why you didn't ever see me in the office. It's like, I've got to get this thing sold. And I've got, so I took turns with my handyman over there. So that, you just can't learn that stuff other than that. So that was probably my worst horrible flip nightmare story. There's plenty of others. And on the good side, the last deal we did was the best one. And, you know, I'm constantly looking for deals, constantly. Even when you tell me not to, I'm just watching. And I've made so many offers over the years that I've been through the numbers so many times that I can often spot a deal right on first blush. You know, I was listening to Donald Trump talking the other day, and I know we're in a hurry, I'm going to talk fast. He was being criticized by someone who was running for president because he didn't have a 29-point plan on all his positions. And Donald said, you know, two of my best investments, I think it was Mar-a-Lago and the old post office in Washington, D.C. he was talking about, he said that he had to instantly recognize them as good investments with his experience and instantly offer because there was a lot of competition. And if he'd taken the time to sit down and do a 29-point plan, he would have lost those properties. So he says there's much to be said about that, but sometimes you just have to have experience that shows you that's a great deal, jump on it right now, don't wait, and then put your plan together. And that's what you do when you tie up a property in escrow. Now you do your due diligence, and you make up for everything you missed because you're going to go through that property with a fine-tooth comb and with professionals. Well, that's what we did on the Sevenplex. I instantly recognized, wow, that is a great deal in a great area of town. I want that property. And you always tell me, don't fall in love with the property. So I'm going, don't fall in love with the property. I just knew it. So then we tied it up. We got a number, and I made the offer. First I made the offer, and the agent laughed at me, told me I was an idiot, and basically just sent me packing. And I went, whatever. I spent a lot of time on that. Too bad for me. So then 3 months later, he came back and said, would you still make that same deal? And we said, yeah, we'll make the same deal. And we tied it up in escrow, and then we inspected the property, found out the parking lot was crap, the roof was leaking all over again, all over the place, because some landlord that didn't know what he was doing let people drill holes in the roof and put satellite dishes all over the roof.
Yeah.
First thing I did was admit to the satellite guys and show them where they put satellite dishes, not on my roof, or I'll break your kneecaps. But so once we went through it, we got the seller to kick in another, wasn't it 30 grand? Come down another 30 grand?
Yep.
To make up for the stuff that we didn't know before. So we beat him up in escrow. We got the property tied up, and then we beat him up in escrow, and we got that property. And we make as much money off that little positive cash flow off that little sevenplex every month than we do on an 18-plex.
Yeah, and that property took a lot of confront. It was a dilapidated property. I think it was, was it owned from somebody in California, Mom? It was a remote landlord?
No, it was a guy retired that was living off the income, but he didn't want to do
guy.
Work.
Okay.
It had good bones, though, Bud. It was brick, good bones, good area of town.
Yeah. And the rents, I mean, when you looked at the rent formula, it you know, we were getting an okay deal. But we thought we could increase those rents by 20%. And turned out after we did our renovation and then with a little help from the way the market has moved in terms of renters, we were able to increase those rents more like 30 or 40%. So it was an awesome deal. And that's a win book, you know, and let me just maybe end on this, if you don't mind, Mom. What I think's coolest about that deal is that that deal will subsidize my mom's income until the day she dies. She'll always have that property and that positive cash flow from the from that work we put in. And then I'll have that cash flow for the next 30 or 40 years. And then I'll die. And then I hope that my kids have that income for another 30 or 40 years. And who knows what they decide to do with it. But I can tell you for sure that it will support my mom until she passes away, and it'll support me until I pass away. And you just, it's hard to say that about a stock, you know? I got Apple at 115. Awesome. You're gonna sell it at 175 or whatever. That's a different kind of— And pay taxes, right. That's a different type of strategy and long-term move the needle type effect than what I see in real estate. So with that, Mom, anything else to add?
Many things to add, but time is short. That was kind of fun.
Oh, well said. Well, hey, listen, thanks so much for sharing so generously. And maybe if we have good response, we'll do another one of these on cash flow. If our listeners want to find you and your websites and resources, how can they best connect with you?
I have a little blog that I just keep up for landlords. It's called motherofalllandlords.com, and they can go there, and I give advice to landlords. And I'll probably add in the future more investment advice now that you've got my nose into this area instead of just landlord advice, and so I'll build on that in the future.
Beautiful. That's motherofalllandlords.com. Thanks, Mom. Appreciate your time, and we'll see you later for a barbecue or something fun.
Okay, thanks, bud. Have fun.